Imagine for a second, you're standing on a massive steel bridge, like the Golden Gate or maybe just the overpass you drive under every day. You look up at these huge steel beams and the welds holding them together, and they just look static,
But
solid.
completely inert. Yeah, they look like they've been there forever and will be there forever.
Exactly. But if you could shrink down, like Ant-Man style, and go inside one of those wells, you'd see a war zone. You'd see atoms literally being pulled apart, just screaming in tension. And the really scary part is, this is happening before a single car has ever even driven across it.
That's a powerful image. And it's not wrong. We see these structures just sitting there, but often they are locked in this state of incredibly high internal stress just from how they were made.
And that is exactly what we're diving into today. This silent killer in our infrastructure called residual stress. But more importantly, we're looking at this amazing solution from a PhD thesis by Timothy Isak Ramjan at Cambridge.
It's a fascinating piece of work because, usually we think about stress in a weld as a problem to solve after the fact.
Right, you treat it.
You treat it. Ramjan's research basically asks, what if we could teach the metal to heal itself during the process? What if we could design it to prevent the problem from ever happening?
So smart metal that fixes its own stress problems, it sounds a little bit like science
A
fiction.
little bit, yeah, but it's grounded in some really, really cool physics. We're talking about something called low transformation temperature alloys, or LTTs. It's all about hacking the crystal structure of the steel itself.
I love that. But before we get to the hero of the story, we have to really get to grips with the villain. So why does welding create all this stress in the first place? It seems like it should just be simple, right? Melt metal, stick things together, let it cool.
Well, it really comes down to this battle between heat and space. When you weld, you're creating this tiny, localized inferno. It's a pool of molten metal that's thousands of degrees hot, sitting right next to this huge, cold plate of steel.
Okay, that huge temperature difference can't be good.
It's the root of the whole problem. I mean, basic physics, right? Things expand when they're hot, they shrink when they cool.
Right.
So picture this. You lay down that bead of hot liquid weld. In that moment, it's expanded. It's taking up as much space as it's ever going to.
Okay, I'm with you.
But as it cools down, it desperately wants to shrink. It wants to contract.
Thermal contraction,
But
yeah.
here's the catch. It's not just cooling in empty space, it's fused. I mean, literally welded to those massive cold base plates on either side. And those plates, they're not shrinking, they are rigid.
Ah, so the weld is trying to get smaller, but the plates are holding it in place.
Exactly. It's like trying to shrink a rubber band that's been nailed to a board at both ends.
That's a great analogy.
The rubber band, which is our weld, it wants to contract, but it can't. So instead of getting smaller, it just gets pulled tighter and tighter. It stretches. And that stretch is what we call tensile residual stress.
And I'm guessing this isn't just a tiny bit of tension.
Oh no. The source material makes it clear this stress can be enormous. We're talking about tension that can actually equal the yield strength of the steel itself.
Wait, yield strength is the point where it starts to permanently deform, right? Where it fails.
That's the one. So think about that bridge again. Before any load is on it, before a single truck, the welds are already stressed to their breaking point. They're just sitting there, humming with tension, waiting for the slightest excuse to fail.
That is genuinely terrifying. It's like your car's engine is already redlining while it's parked in the driveway.
And that's exactly why fatigue is such a huge problem. You add just a little bit of extra stress from traffic, and because the baseline stress is already maxed out, bang, the structure's lifespan just plummets.
So normally we'd fix this with what, post-weld treatments? Like heating the whole thing up in a giant oven or something?
Yeah, post-weld heat treatment is the common one. But think about it. You could do that for a small part. You could hold in your hand. You can't put a suspension bridge in an oven.
Right.
It's expensive, it's slow. Sometimes it's just impossible. Which brings us back to Ramjan's thesis. He says, don't treat the symptom, let's change the actual physics.
And this is where the LTT alloys come in, the hero of the story.
Exactly. This is where the chemistry gets really clever. The thesis calls it exploiting phase transformations.
Okay, unpack phase transformation for me. It sounds complicated.
It's really just about how the atoms arrange themselves. Steel isn't just one thing. It has different crystal structures or phases depending on its temperature.
Different personalities, kind of.
That's a great way to put it. At very high temperatures, steel is in a phase called austenite. The atoms are packed together really efficiently. It's a dense, tight structure.
Okay, dense packing. Got it.
But as the weld cools down very quickly, those atoms want to rearrange. They want to switch to a different personality called martensite.
And what's martensite like?
Martensite is incredibly hard and strong, but it's structurally inefficient. The atoms form this jagged, needle-like pattern. And here's the crucial part. It takes up more space.
Wait, it takes up more space as it's cooling?
Yes. That is the magic trick. When austenite transforms into martensite, the material physically expands. There's a net volume increase.
Oh, okay. I think I see where this is going. So you have two forces fighting each other inside the weld as it cools.
You've got it. Force one is thermal contraction. The whole thing is getting colder, so it wants to shrink.
Okay.
Force two is the phase transformation. The atoms are rearranging into martensite, so it wants to expand.
And in a normal weld, the shrinking wins, right? Because you end up with all that tension.
Exactly. In standard steel, the transformation happens way too early at around, say, 500 degrees Celsius. So it transforms, it expands a tiny bit, but then it still has 480 degrees of cooling left to do.
So it has all that time to shrink again.
Right. All that thermal contraction just completely overwhelms the expansion. You're right back where you started, with the weld pulling itself apart.
So how does the smart alloy, the LTT alloy, change that equation?
It's all about timing. Ramjan's work uses alloys with a lot of nickel and chromium to basically delay that transformation. You're suppressing the change until the temperature is much, much lower.
How low are we talking?
We're talking about getting the martensite start temperature, the MS, down to around 200 Celsius, sometimes even lower.
Okay, so walk me through it. The smart weld is cooling. It's shrinking, building up all that bad tension.
Yep, it's pulling on the plates. But then, right at the end of the race, just as it's getting close to room temperature around 200 degrees, bam, the phase transformation finally kicks in.
The austenite snaps into martensite, the whole thing expands.
And because it happens so late in the game, it doesn't just cancel out the shrinkage.
Yeah.
If you design it right, it overpowers it. The weld actually ends up trying to push outwards.
So instead of pulling the plates apart, it's pushing them together.
Precisely. You've completely flipped the script from tensile stress to compressive stress. And for a fatigue crack, compression is like a force field. A crack can't open up if the material is being squeezed shut.
The numbers in the thesis were pretty amazing. It said conventional alloys end up with negative strain shrinkage, but the LTT alloys showed a final expansion of around 0.55%. That doesn't sound like a lot, but in metallurgy, that's huge, isn't it?
It is a massive difference. It's the difference between failure and, you know, a 50-year lifespan. It fundamentally changes the entire joint.
Now, this is all great in theory, but Ramjan's work looked at the messy real world, because welding isn't just one clean line in a lab.
No, absolutely not. For anything thick, like a ship's hull or an excavator arm, you can't weld it in one go. You have to lay down bead after bead after bead. It's called multi-pass welding.
And that just sounds like it would ruin everything. You lay down your first magic LTT bead, it cools down and does its expansion trick, and then you come along with a torch and blast it with heat again for the second layer. Doesn't that just reset the whole thing?
That is the absolute key challenge he had to solve. It's all about thermal cycling. Every new pass reheats the layers below it. You could mess up the structure. You could undo all that good compressive stress you just created.
So what was the solution?
It's a really elegant strategy, actually. It's about managing the interpass temperature. He found you have to keep the weld warm between each pass.
Keep it warm. But I thought we wanted it to cool down to get the expansion.
Eventually, yes. But not yet. The trick is to keep the entire stack of weld layers above that 200-degree transformation temperature while you're still working. You're keeping the whole thing in this sort of austenitic purgatory. It's waiting to transform, but you don't let it.
So you do layer one, keep it hot, layer two, keep it hot, layer three. They're all just sitting there as austenite.
Exactly. You build up the entire joint in that high temperature phase.
Yeah.
Then, and only then, when you're all done, you let the whole thing cool down as one single unit.
And they all transform together.
Right. You get this massive, coherent expansion across the entire thickness of the weld. The data showed this was the key to preserving the compressive benefit in these really thick joints.
That's incredibly clever, but it also sounds really hard to do on a construction site.
It is a logistical challenge, no doubt. But that was just one problem. The other one he ran into was something called dilution.
Right. This sounded like watering down a good drink.
That's not a bad way to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, welding isn't just melting the filler wire. The heat melts part of the base plates you're joining, and it all gets mixed together in the puddle.
And the base plates are just plain old steel. They don't have all the fancy nickel and chromium.
Precisely. So your high-tech LTP filler wire gets mixed with low-tech base plate, and your recipe gets thrown off. You might start with 10% nickel in the wire, but the actual weld only ends up with 7%.
And the chemistry controls that transformation temperature.
Yep. Less nickel means the transformation happens at a higher temperature. It might kick in at 350 degrees instead of 200, and poof, the magic is gone. The shrinkage wins again.
So what do? Just add way more nickel to the wire to begin with?
That's basically it. The thesis calls it judicious alloy design. You have to over-engineer the filler wire. You make it extra rich in those key elements, knowing that it's going to get diluted down to the perfect concentration once it mixes in the weld pool.
You're making the cocktail mix way too strong because you know the ice is going to melt and water it down.
That's a perfect analogy. You have to anticipate the contamination and compensate for it in your starting ingredients.
So we have the theory, the practical application, but this is the part that really got me. How on earth did they know any of this was actually happening? You can't see stress. How did he prove the inside of the metal was expanding?
This is where the science goes to another level. You can't use X-rays. X-rays are great for looking at the surface, but they can't get deep into steel. So Ramjan used neutron diffraction.
Neutrons, like from a nuclear reactor?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
He had to use these huge specialized facilities. The thesis mentions Enginex in the UK and Stress Spec in Germany. They shoot beams of neutrons at the steel.
And why are neutrons better for this?
They just have incredible penetration power. A neutron has no charge, so it can sail right through an inch of solid steel.
Wow.
And they're measuring the strain by using the metal's own atomic structure as a tiny ruler.
How does that work?
Well, imagine the atoms are arranged in perfect rows.
Mm-hmm.
If the metal is in tension being pulled apart, the distance between those rows gets a little bit bigger.
And if it's in compression, they get squashed together.
Exactly. The neutrons bounce off these atomic planes, and by measuring the angle they come out at, you can calculate the spacing between atoms with unbelievable precision.
That's mind-blowing. He's literally measuring the space between individual atoms to see if a weld is safe.
It allowed him to create a map of the stress deep inside the material.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that the stress on the surface, what you'd measure with X-rays, was often completely different from the stress in the bulk.
So you could think you're safe based on a surface measurement, but deep down the thing is ready to crack.
A very dangerous situation. But the neutron data confirmed that the LTT alloys were creating that beneficial compression exactly where it was needed most, at the weld toe.
The weld toe.
It's that little corner where the curved surface of the weld meets the flat plate. It's a natural stress riser.
Mm-hmm.
In almost all fatigue failures, that's where the crack begins. It's the Achilles heel of a weld.
And the LTT alloy put it into compression.
Deep compression.
Yeah.
It essentially put a protective shield around the weakest point.
Which brings us to the payoff. Does it actually work? Does it make the weld last longer?
The fatigue testing was pretty definitive. The research shows that the LTT alloys basically doubled the fatigue limit. They saw the strengths go from about 65 megapascals up to 130.
Doubling it. In engineering, getting a 10% improvement is a huge win. Doubling it is unheard of.
It's a step change. And what was really telling was where the LTT samples finally failed when they pushed them to the absolute limit.
You said cracks always start at the toe.
Almost always. But in the LTT welds, the toe was so protected by that compressive stress that a crack couldn't start there. The failure had to find a new place to begin. It would shift to some other tiny internal defect, like a gas pore.
So you effectively eliminated the number one cause of failure.
You made the weakest link so strong that it was no longer the weakest link.
Mm.
That's a colossal achievement.
I have to play devil's advocate for a second, though. We've been talking up this martensite phase, but isn't martensite famous for being not just hard, but also really brittle, like glass?
You're absolutely right. That is the classic trade-off. Hardness often comes at the cost of toughness.
And isn't there that thing called hydrogen cracking or cold cracking,
yeah,
where if you have martensite and even a little bit of humidity, the weld can just spontaneously crack hours later?
That is the big fear, and you're spot on. To get hydrogen cracking, you traditionally need three things.
Yeah.
You need that susceptible microstructure, which is martensite.
That guy.
You need hydrogen, which can come from moisture in the air.
Check.
And you need tensile stress.
Ah, but we don't have that.
We don't have that. In fact, we have the exact opposite. You need tension to pull the atoms apart so the tiny hydrogen atoms can sneak in and break the bonds. Here, we have a compressive bear hug, squeezing everything together.
So the compression protects the martensite from its own brittleness.
That's a perfect way to put it. It saves it from itself. The thesis confirmed this. The LTT welds showed great resistance to cracking, despite being fully martensitic. The physics works.
So, zooming out, What's the big picture here? Are we going to see this stuff in every building and every car tomorrow?
Probably not everywhere, no. The alloys are expensive, nickel costs a lot of money, and the process requires tight control. You wouldn't use it to weld a garden gate.
But for the big stuff.
For high-stakes structures, absolutely. Think about offshore wind turbines getting hammered by waves 2047, deep-sea oil pipelines, the hulls of massive ships. For those applications, this is a revolutionary technology.
It feels like a real shift in the whole philosophy of engineering.
It really is.
Yeah.
For a century, the mindset has been, build it, then fix its problems. You weld the part, then you heat treat it to relieve the stress.
And this is build the solution into the material itself.
Exactly. It's part of this bigger move towards smart materials. We're getting to a point where we're not just designing beams and plates anymore. We're designing the actual crystal structures to do the work for us.
It just shows you can't be siloed anymore. To solve these problems, you have to be a mechanical engineer, a material scientist, and a physicist all at once.
The lines are definitely blurring.
Yeah.
But that's where the real breakthroughs are happening, right at those intersections.
So here's the thought I want to leave everyone with. The next time you're on a plane or crossing a bridge, think about that invisible war going on inside the metal. For years, stress was winning. But now we're actually learning how to arm the atoms themselves to fight back.
And it makes you wonder, right, if we can teach metal to heal its own stress by controlling how it cools, what other invisible problems in our world could be solved by just changing the atomic recipe instead of just making things bigger?
A fascinating future to think about. That's all we have for this deep dive. Thanks for listening.
My pleasure. Thanks.